Hello, the sound of superstar pianist, composer and bandleader Herbie Hancock with one of his best loved compositions, Cantaloupe Island. And on today's show, in the company of fellow pianist Jason Rabello, I'll be shining a spotlight on Herbie's remarkable artistry. Plus, we'll be hearing from the great man himself.
My first car, which I still own.
Really?
It's an AC Cobra. And I paid $6,000 for it. That was 1963.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Now the car is worth anywhere from $300,000 to $500,000. I bought it with the first money that I made from the royalties from Watermelon Man.
Herbie Hancock, and much more from Herbie coming up later. Also on the program, jazz lineup reporter Phil Smith talks to a range of jazz pianists about how different environments affect how they approach playing. Where is a jazz musician at his or her most honest, playing alone at home or on stage in front of an audience? 2016 has been a good year for jazz, and in particular for piano, with debuts In My Room from multi-instrumentalist Jacob Collier, Solo Gemini from composer Nicky Yeo, and pianist Gwilym Simcock has been touring with superstar guitarist Pat Metheny. Jason Rabello, today's special guest, also released his solo piano album, Held, and is featured on saxophonist Tim Garland's 2016 album. This is Semi for Peace.
Thank you.
Saxophonist Tim Garland with drummer Asaf Sirkis and guitarist Ant Law with his reference to Turkish Sufi music in 6/8 meter semi, featuring my special guest Jason Rebello on piano. Jason joins me shortly to appreciate and marvel in the music of a pioneering jazz musician who continues to impact popular culture, collaborate with musicians from classical and African music, all whilst retaining his status as a preeminent musical icon at the forefront of jazz. Yes, it's the incredible Mr. Herbie Hancock. "4 A.M." by Herbie Hancock from his album Mr. Hands in the company of Jaco Pastorius on bass and Harvey Mason on drums. And joining me to share his love and passion for the music of Herbie Hancock is one of the UK's most gifted pianists and band leaders, Jason Rebello. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Julian.
It's great to have you here. Herbie Hancock, what is it that's so special about Herbie for you?
I think for me, the thing that's always attracted me as a musician is he just seems to have a balance of all the things that I admire and respect and love about music. So he has an incredible technique and knowledge of harmony and rhythm, but all of that is combined with this incredible inventiveness and spontaneity, and also the fact that he manages to combine so many different kinds of music. He's so open-minded, and you know, he's one of the few artists that have actually kind of created genres of music. And also, you know, just the way he plays, he's had such an influence on the piano players that followed. I mean, what is missing?
It's true. It's absolutely true. Well, we'll also be hearing from Herbie Hancock himself. Well, Herbie was born in Chicago, Illinois on the 7th of April 1940 and started the piano at the age of 7. Just a few years later, at the age of 11, he would be making his concert debut with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Within the next 10 years, at 20, he would be moving to New York under the guidance of trumpeter, bandleader and mentor Donald Byrd and become immersed in the most vibrant and stimulating jazz scene. And he'll also record his first album for Blue Note in 1962, the beginning of an illustrious career. Well, we're going to go to an interview of Herbie, the first one I ever did with him. And this is him talking in 2000 about his family and the music that he grew up around.
My mother took piano lessons when she was a kid, and she used to sing when she was very young.
Yes.
My father also took piano lessons when he was a kid
and
sang in the church, and that was about it. By the time I came along, he continued to sing in the choir and church. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the churches we attended had four choirs. Mm-hmm. There was the young people's choir and a young people's gospel choir.
I see.
And then there was the choir and the gospel choir.
Okay.
So the choir and the young people's choir, they sang hymns.
Right.
And the young people's gospel choir and the gospel choir did them great gospel stuff. I mean, they got the church rocking. You know?
So that's what you were growing up listening to then?
Yeah, I was listening to that and rhythm and blues and classical music at the same time.
Of course,
because
my
mother wanted her children to have, quote, culture, unquote.
Herbie Hancock speaking with me in 2000 about his childhood and the different kinds of music that he was exposed to, or certainly the things that were important in his family and in his life, going to church. Well, next up, here's a piece with Donald Byrd, who was such an important catalyst in Herbie's life and career. An excellent band leader and trumpeter, he gave him guidance and support into the professional world of music. This track is an example of how supremely adept he is playing a tune from the standard repertoire and how seasoned he is already at the age of 20. Herbie Hancock, a month before his 21st birthday, on Mr. Lucky, with Lamon Jackson on bass, the legendary Jimmy Cobb on drums, in the quintet led by both baritone master Pepper Adams and trumpet great Donald Byrd. Jason, what an amazing piece of music and playing.
It's just incredible. It's so unpredictable, even though he's staying within that framework. It's all unpredictable.
But it's also interesting that there is a framework, there is a language. It then becomes poetry, it then becomes a story, doesn't it?
It's not like the language is restricting you. It's just allowing you to start, you know.
And it leads us into deeper questions about music, because if you think of us as human beings, we're merely just a frame to a soul. And the soul and the personality or whoever we are comes through as we exist.
Yeah, we're sort of bursting to come out, isn't it? And it's,
absolutely.
And the freedom of it is to let it come out, you know, through the language of the time that you're in. But that free expression of it means that you can listen to something 50 years ago and you hear that coming out. The language doesn't even matter, you know.
Absolutely. Well, here's more Herbie with me in 2000 about Donald Byrd.
Donald became my roommate.
Right.
And he functioned sort of like a big brother to me, you know. And he happens to have the kind of personality that nurtures young people. He has his doctorate degree in education.
Right.
And that's part of his soul, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, kind of raising people, you know. And he certainly did that for me. I mean, he helped me in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. He's responsible for me establishing Hancock Music Company.
Right.
And the song Watermelon Man being in my publishing company.
Right.
It was Donald that did that.
Oh, I see.
He's also responsible for me purchasing my first car, which I still own.
Really?
It's an AC Cobra. And I paid $6,000 for it. That was 1963.
Wow.
Now the car is worth anywhere from $300,000 to $500,000. I bought it with the first money that I made from the royalties from Watermelon Man back in 1963.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that car, it represents the beginning of my career.
Right.
Thank you.
Herbie Hancock and Watermelon Man from his debut album in 1962, Taken Off, released on the Blue Note label, and his first taste of popular music success, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, probably like there is now, there was a sort of pressure from record companies to come up with something hip, you know, and he sort of managed to find a way of satisfying that direction, if you like, and yet writing a song that has lasted and is played still today by kids and adults all over the world. It's probably his most famous tune. That's amazing, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Well, he talks about that because when he first signed with Blue Note, they often got you to play some standards and, you know, you had to play like a funky number.
Yeah, that's
and, it. And Donald Byrd's like, write your own music.
Yeah.
And he said, and he wrote his own funky number.
Yeah.
And, you know, it all really paid off. And they wanted the publishing. But Donald Byrd said no. He said, set up your own publishing. Mm. And he says, in the meeting, he says, no, I've already got my own publishing company. He hadn't even started it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, oh, okay, then, well, you can keep it.
Good move.
You know what I mean? So Good it move. All really, really worked out. So he does have a lot to thank Donald Byrd for, you know. Mm. But it's also interesting that over the course of his career, he has kept straddling both the popular culture and this hardcore jazz thing. Mm. Really interesting, isn't it?
I love that. I mean, it's the open-mindedness. It's the kind of childlike interest in what's going on without dismissing anything. Mm. And as you say, you know, you get the kind of, you know, the classical harmonic complexities of contemporary classical music. Mm. And then you get the kind of the current genres and styles of pop and R&B and, you know, all mixed together in this sort of kind of soup, and then it comes out sounding completely unique, you know. He's kind of not really rejecting anything. It's all seen, he sees it all, the value in everything. He's not, like, playing one thing off against another, you know, and I think it's so rich, the result. He did a gig at the Hammersmith Odeon. In that gig, he played Chameleon, and he did the solo. I just never had heard anything like that in my life. Just seeing that live, for me, that was the moment where I just saw that and thought, whatever this is, because I didn't really know what it was. I said, whatever that is, I want to be part of that. That was the sort of moment that, if there were any doubts about doing music, they were gone in that moment. And I remember that sealed the deal for me.
We'll be right back. From Herbie Hancock's groundbreaking album Headhunters, that was the jazz funk classic Chameleon, featuring the life-changing Fender Rhodes keyboard solo for Jason Rebello. We'll hear more on Herbie, his life, and his music later on the show with Jason. You're listening to Jazz Lineup with the best of jazz from the UK and beyond here on BBC Radio 3 with me, Julian Joseph. Still to come, more music from tonight's featured artist Herbie Hancock in the company of pianist Jason Rebello, and it's with the piano we'll stay. Jazz Lineup's Phil Smith reports from Berlin and looks at how a musician's performance may be affected by the environment they play in. He concentrates specifically on the piano, featuring pianist Mark Schmolling, Shea Maestro, and Matthew Bourne.
There's a particular Sun Ra recording that I love. We're in his apartment, Chicago, around 1955. The details of recording date are sketchy. I like the honesty of it, that you can hear the creak of his chair as he reaches for higher octaves. I like getting to hear the musical ideas so clearly. It feels like we're a neighbour in the hallway, listening in on a private moment from the other side of the door. I like the mood. Here's another home recording, some 60 years later. The tape machine has become a smartphone, and it's the pianist and composer Mark Schmolling, in his flat, in Berlin, capturing a moment for himself, the early stages of a composition called Haiku.
When I'm alone with the piano, this is almost a feeling of being home. And all of a sudden you play something and it's coming and it's going again. And also the silence in between the playing, I love very much actually. Or other sounds from the backyard maybe. The piano was like, since I can think, for me something to create something. I was always curious what's happening when you press the keys and what, like, of course, like many childs, they just, you know, like with the hands. It was fascinating to me. I really cannot say why. It was always like entering and entering the world and being home at the same time.
Home is where the piano is. I'm not sure if I came up with this phrase or if I read it somewhere, but I don't really think it matters. I'm interested in what these ideas, home and piano, have to do with each other, and what they mean to jazz pianists in particular. Mark Schmolling and I are fellow Berliners, and so I invited him round to join me in my kitchen, where my upright piano is, to discuss the phrase and to help me translate a letter I had received. The letter reads,
I'm trying. Dear neighbor.
Lieber Nachbar.
Which the dear you can leave out, actually. Dear neighbor.
Bitte reduzieren Sie Ihr Klavierspiel.
Please reduce your piano playing.
Man hört es im gesamten Himmel.
You can hear it in the complete backyard, especially in summer.
Besonders im Sommer, wenn die Fenster
when the windows love to be opened.
Ist dies untragbar.
This is unbearable.
Vielen Dank für Ihr Verständnis.
Many thanks
Ihre
for
Nachbarn.
Your understanding. Your neighbors.
And I don't know what reduce my piano playing as well. I don't know if that means like play less thick chords.
Yeah, maybe less notes. You could also reduce the volume, of course. You could also reduce it to a certain kind of genre. You could also reduce this just using less fingers.
Overhearing piano. It's like turning up early at a gig. The musicians are sound checking, chatting, working things out. I caught up with Israeli pianist Shai Maestro before a recent concert. The other band members had left, and he was on stage, getting to know the piano.
I remember being in Japan, solo tour. I remember trying to sit on stage, and you can do that when you're alone, the music is very flexible. I tried, you know, to sit on stage and to stop seeing it as my performance. To get out of the situation where there's an audience and I'm playing and I'm the one who should deliver the energies and I'm the one who should create something, and I was just like, okay, if I just sit on stage and I just listen, close my eyes and try to feel what's going on around me, whatever, 100, 200 or 50 people in the room. And then when I started playing, it wasn't starting, it was like continuing something that was already happening. And that for me was a very interesting experience, because yeah, it's always different when you're on stage, but a lot because you get into this state of mind of like, I'm performing now, you know? And I find it very beautiful to not perform and to just be.
Home is where the piano is.
That's very true. That's actually very, very true. You know, I'll travel to whatever, Bangladesh or Japan or places that I've never been before, and then you sit on stage and there's this friend, you know, there's this creature that I know so well, this entity. It's like, that's, you know, that's your bed, that's your kitchen, that's your couch, you know, what were you frequent, like G minor. Oh, I know G minor, you know. And it's really, really great. I thought about it recently that I mean, musicians are very fortunate that we can live anywhere and feel home.
Thank you. pianist Chai Maestro performing When You Stop Seeing. Now, if a piano chord falls in the middle of a Yorkshire dale and no one's around to overhear it, does it make a sound?
Hello?
I phoned up pianist Matthew Bourne, just to be sure.
It's an interesting question, because it's something I've kind of grappled with since moving house, in that I moved to a place where, just to touch on your neighbour's note, I can kind of play and not disturb anyone, which means I can record and not disturb anyone as well. And for me, I've traditionally only ever recorded music when I've been in a performance context.
We'll end with a track from Matthew Bourne playing his piano at home. The piece is called Isotap.
I don't sit down and compose pieces. I sit down and I make them up. So the difference between those two things is simply a state of mind. So, I mean, I might come in after being out and come in and sit at the piano and play something. And occasionally I'll think, oh, that's interesting. I've ended up capturing loads of these pieces. So they're going to be my next album. So the kind of pieces that I've recorded here, by surprise.
Ice Attack, recorded and performed by its composer Matthew Bourne at his home in Yorkshire. Our thanks to Phil Smith for that feature, and you can find out details of all the tracks included on our website. This is Jazz Lineup with me, Julian Joseph, bringing you the best of jazz from the UK and beyond. And next, a piece from exciting Chicago-born trumpeter Marquis Hill. Over the past 5 years, Hill's built up a reputation as a fresh force in jazz. He won the Thelonious Monk Jazz Competition in 2014, from which he gained a recording contract with the Concord label. Marquis calls his warm and full-sounding band of 4 years the Black Tet, with bass, drums, and vibraphone, topped off by the alto of Joshua Ramos and Hill himself.
simple, different life. Same chicken, different spice. Listen to all that flavor, savor every note. It tastes like hope and smell like Blue Note. All this lemon pepper mixed with this trouble, the way we play signifying from which we came. Black always in season, sprinkled with all this seasoning. It's healing in these hands. For every Sandy Hook, there's five Sandra Blands. The way we play sounds like we threw away the plans. This the church kitchen with one ceiling fan. The way we play, the archetypal ancestor to his successors, contemporaries, imitators, all of the above. The way we play is the way we love.
gifted Chicago trumpet man Marquis Hill and the opening poetry of the title track of his album, The Way We Play, and meshed into the jazz standard Minority. Well, we'll stay with the talent from Chicago as my special guest Jason Rebello and I continue our celebration of one of the Windy City's most famous sons, Herbie Hancock. Here's Herbie talking about how his trumpet-playing mentor Donald Byrd set up Herbie's first meeting with Miles Davis that would change the course of his life, music, and thinking.
Donald introduced me to Miles Davis sometime either late 61, but I think it was more early 62.
Yes.
Just to meet Miles.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do it because I was scared.
Yes.
And then when I got to Miles' house, he took me to his recreation room and he had his piano there. And Miles said, play something. You know, and... So I was so nervous, I could only play a ballad,
right.
You know? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to play anything up-tempo.
Yeah.
So I think I played Stella by Starlight or something.
Mm-hmm.
And Miles said, nice touch, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I was so thrilled that Miles gave me a compliment about my touch.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then I had no idea that maybe a year and a half later that I'd be working with Miles. I never even dreamed that that would happen.
Thank you.
Herbie Hancock on All of You with Ron Carter on bass, Tony Williams on the drums, George Coleman on tenor saxophone, and leading from the trumpet, Miles Davis, from the album My Funny Valentine, from their 1964 concert at the Philharmonic Hall of the Lincoln Center in New York City. And Jason, an example of why this band is so admired and beloved. And what a solo.
I wish everyone could have heard us singing along to it. It's just exhilarating, isn't it?
But, you know, one of the things about listening and loving jazz music is that there are a lot of people who have gone from jazz into popular music and have a reputation as a great jazz artist, but make it in a commercial field. But the true greats in jazz, it's not just the music they make, it's the solos.
And that's
just an example of one of the many solos you can sing along with that have changed so many people's lives. Well, let's go back to my interview with Herbie talking about this great band.
The influence of Miles Davis's band
was
kind of a cornerstone in my own development of my pattern of thinking that continues to this day. And fortunately, I was with that great mentor during my 20s, which is a time when you are first trying to develop and find out about your own individual style. And to play in a group like that, you know, having, you know, Tony Williams on drums, I mean, a phenomenon.
Absolutely.
And Ron Carter, top bass player. You know, first George Coleman, then Wayne Shorter, the top composer and saxophonist, and Miles Davis. I couldn't have been in a better environment, you know, for that kind of development, whereby Miles encouraged an open way of looking at music and looking at life, you know, and trying always to create new ways of doing things. Miles would have fired us if we had played something the same as we did before. You know, he told us, I pay you to practice on the bandstand, on the stage, in front of the people, not just in your room. So that becomes the operating table. You know, for us practitioners of the art of music.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, just like a doctor practices medicine. You know, we're practicing music, you know, right there. The patient is right there, which is the music and the lives of those people and how it affects the people. And Miles only wanted the truth. He wanted us to capture the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why most of the records that I did with Miles, most of them, what you hear on the record is the first take.
Right.
If we got past the melody, that was going to be on the record, no matter what.
I'm Julian Joseph, and I'm celebrating the music of pianist extraordinaire Herbie Hancock in the company of British pianist extraordinaire Jason Robello. You chose the album Speak Like a Child, and what's so special about this record for you?
You know, this was his solo album, and he's using the things that he learned with Miles, but he's kind of finding his own way of representing that outside of Miles's band. And there's a sort of warmth and gentleness that I love from this album. And I don't know if it's the sound or just the approach. There's a sort of mellowness combined with the experimentation that has a very unique flavour. It's a kind of really chilled out album and yet not boring. It's still exciting.
I remember when you learned the solo on Sorcerer.
And sometimes I get my students to learn it because I think it just has that beautiful sort of poise of creativity and chilled outness to it.
Well, from his 1968 album, Speak Like a Child, this is The Sorcerer. Herbie Hancock from his 1968 album Speak Like a Child, and The Sorcerer with Ron Carter on bass and Mickey Roker on the drums. A few years earlier, Jason, Herbie released the album Maiden Voyage, a simple yet elegant piece he'd written for a television commercial. And film and television have been an important aspect of his craft also.
His passion is communication, you know, and he wants to be involved in whatever form of communication it is, whether it's film or music or song, Or dance. I mean, even dance with the rocket stuff. I mean, that was that was break dancing, you know. Yeah. So he's interested in communicating with people and eager to do whatever form that takes.
Well, I always loved his writing on the film Death Wish.
Mm-hmm.
A beautiful score. And he had said to me that after he did that film, he went to get orchestration lessons. And he said that the orchestration teacher had gone to see the film, and he's like, I saw that film. I really love the orchestration. What are you doing here? He goes, well, I want to learn about orchestration.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, you really don't need to be here.
Right.
So I know the next piece you've chosen comes from a television show, and actually an animated show called Hey, 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 It's Fat Albert, which was a cartoon in 69. The album Fat Albert Rotunda is part of the popular sound.
Mm-hmm.
He also has grown the forces he's writing for. And what is it about this particular track that you've chosen? Because you've chosen Tell Me a Bedtime Story.
Yeah, it sort of relates to when we were singing along with the solo. And most people, pop music, they sing along with pop music and they love it. And it's not an intellectual thing.
Yeah.
But see, for jazz, a lot of people think it's an intellectual thing, but it isn't for us, at least.
No,
because I sing with the same joy that someone will sing along to, you know, We Will Rock You or something.
Absolutely.
So it's no different. It's not an intellectual highbrow thing.
No.
And I think the melody is like, it's one of those tunes that you think you've known all your life. It's a pop hit in my world.
Well, let's go straight to that. From the album Fat Albert Rotunda from 1969, this is Tell Me a Bedtime Story.
Thank you.
Herbie Hancock, and tell me a bedtime story from the album Fat Albert Rotunda, inspired by his own soundtrack for the television animated special Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. This takes us into a period of Herbie's music where he's experimenting and he's in the search for a peaceful way forward for humanity in a time of psychedelia and spiritual openness. And here's Herbie talking about editing and concepts from the 60s that influence today and the effect Buddhism has had on his life.
Part of the construction was through editing,
right,
which, by the way, happens today.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, yeah.
There were a lot of concepts that kind of originated during the 60s that find themselves being emulated or being a heavy influence on mm-hmm. certain things that are happening today. Mm-hmm. For example, The Last Poets.
Right, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Today that has resulted in what we call rap.
Yeah.
But they were doing that. Back then. You know. Miles was always encouraging us to try to find new solutions each time to performing a piece. And, mm-hmm. and that's why the band played a music that was so open. Mm-hmm. And he also encouraged us, without saying it verbally, mm-hmm. to trust our own feelings and trust our ability to be able to respond to whatever happened, whatever occurred musically, mm-hmm. you know, that we would have a response that would work toward making it work.
Right.
And it was later on, mm-hmm. through practicing Buddhism, that mm-hmm. I began to see how many of the things that Miles told me to apply to music, mm-hmm. I could apply to my life.
Right, yeah.
You know, and then, it's made all the difference in the world.
Herbie Hancock and Butterfly from the album Thrust, recorded in 1974 with Benny Maupin on saxes, bass clarinet and flute, Paul Jackson on bass, Mike Clark on drums and Bill Summers on percussion. Selected by my special guest Jason Rebello. And Jason, his music has gone through yet another transformation.
Yeah, he's sort of really embracing the technology now and combining that with his lovely kind of way he hears bass clarinet and flute and this, you know, flugelhorn as well, and just from a sort of sonic point of view, is it's actually quite raw. Like the bass clarinet is loud and kind of fuzzy and you know, kind of everything is really raw, and yet the combination is this creamy kind of sexy kind of mellow, you know, incredible sound. That exactly as you were saying earlier, where you just go, oh, Herbie. You know, he's the only one that flavour is very unique to him.
Pianist and composer Herbie Hancock from the 1981 album Quartet, with Ron Carter on bass, Tony Williams on drums, and the 19-year-old trumpeter Wynton Marsalis. Just imagine, Jason, 2 years later, Herbie's redefining popular music as a seminal creator of the hip-hop movement with the release of the single Rocket from the album Future Shock. So he's doing these things. In recent times now, education and humanitarianism have been priorities in Herbie's work and thinking. He's an ambassador for UNESCO, he's a high-profiled representative for the Thelonious Monk Institute, and has set up his own Rhythm of Life Foundation. Artistically, he continues at the highest level, ignoring boundaries and inspiring countless generations of musicians and listeners with his talent, soul, and genius. In 2008, he won Album of the Year at the Grammy Awards, only the second time in Grammy history that a jazz album has won that category. Now in his 76th year, Herbie Hancock still demands the highest level of existence as a musician and humanitarian, and our last track honors his association with both Joni Mitchell and longtime collaborator Wayne Shorter, as he and Wayne bring their inimitable alchemy on Joni's Edith and the Kingpin, sang by a wonderful-sounding Tina Turner. And Jason, thank you so much for being my guest, for sharing your enthusiasm, your deep insight and love for Herbie Hancock's music. And it's just a pleasure to have you here.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure for me. Thank you, Julian. It's so funny that sometimes I've been about to say something as we've been listening and you've just gone, I know.
The big man arrives. Disco dancers greet him. Plain clothes cops greet him. Small town big man, fresh lipstickless name. Sophomore jive from Victims of Typewriters. The band sounds like typewriters. The big man, he's not listening. His eyes hold Edith, His left hand holds his right. What does that hand desire? That he grips it so tight. Edith in the ring, the past over girls are conferring. The man with a diamond ring is purring, all claws for now withdrawn. One by one they bring his renegade stories to her, his crimes and his glories to her. In challenge they look on. Women he has taken grow old too soon. He tilts their tired faces gently to the
Edith and the Kingpin, featuring Tina Turner from Herbie Hancock's Grammy Award-winning album River, The Joni Letters. And my thanks to Jason Rabella for sharing his wonderful and enthusiastic insights on all things Herbie. That's just about it for this week. Jazz Now will be here on Monday night at 11 with music from Sounds of Denmark Festival, featuring an acoustic set from the trio Hess AC Hess Space Lab. And we'll be back next Saturday with another chance to hear Cuban pianist Roberto Fonseca in concert at Gateshead Jazz Festival, plus an interview with piano giant Kenny Barron. I'll leave you tonight with a taster from Roberto Fonseca. This is Cubano Chant from his Impulse release ABUC. Till next time, from me, Julian Joseph. Bye-bye.